Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. He is the Tarantino part of Scott and Tarantino. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to welcome him to the studio and we're going to have a really incredible conversation today. So welcome the Tarantino part. Hello.
Hey, hello.
Oh, I forgot to say. Okay. So the Tarantino part, he's the Tarantino part of Scott and Tarantino, the book Looking for Legends. I've spent the last couple of weeks reading it. I feel like I've been around the world. I feel like I know these people personally. So I totally recommend this book. If you like to travel, but you don't want to travel, you will feel like you have traveled in some of the most incredible parts of the world. So thank you so much for writing it, you and Scott. And welcome.
So everybody's going to want to know, what's with the Scott? Well, she's Barbara Scott. She's my wife, and we're a perfect pair. She is the inspiration, and I am the perspiration. So the team.
So who? I'm assuming you both like to travel, or did?
I like to do anything that she likes to do. And we love to travel. Yes.
Wow. I think we all need a man like you. Wow. All right, ladies, he's taken, but you know what? Maybe we can clone him or something. So Barbara is a lucky, lucky woman, right? And I know when we talked earlier, you told me about how you guys met. Would you tell that story again? Sure. So the audience, it's a wonderful story.
We met at Princeton. I was Princeton class of 1969, just yesterday, and she was a mother of four, a three-sport coach at a local girls' school, and the rules of basketball were changing. She needed an assistant, and I was one of only 92 high school basketball captains in the freshman class. I volunteered. And 4 years later, when I graduated, I told her, I hope I can find somebody just like you. And 13 years later, I did.
And it was her.
Couldn't get more like her. She does have a twin sister, and I'm kind of sweet on her, too. But Barbara's my girl.
Oh, so wait. Okay, so let's back up. You were graduating from Princeton in 1969. So you were 21?
22.
Okay. And you, when you said there were all those high school basketball graduates, what do you mean by that?
Well, I was a freshman in the freshman class. And in my freshman class, we had 92 high school basketball captains. It's a joke. I was only one of them. I tried out for the basketball team, didn't last very long, but I still was pretty good. And, okay. I was her assistant coach.
So when was that? When you were at Princeton or after you graduated?
At Princeton. Four nice years.
So, okay. So you graduated in 69. So this was prior to that,
yes,
obviously.
Right.
Okay. So you met her, wow.
Okay. 1965.
Oh, okay. All right. So you worked with her for 4 years. You graduated. You went off. 13 years later, how did you find her again?
It was meant to be. Actually, what I like to tell everybody is she was going through a divorce. Her husband was leaving her for a younger woman. Mm. And she got an even younger man. Except what I like to say is, ma'am, the best financial advice that I can give you is to marry me. I didn't say it, but it was a good line.
And why is that?
It's a joke.
Oh, okay. I thought because I don't know why I thought. Okay, good. All right. So you met her. She was going through a divorce, and you kindly stepped in as the leading man.
Familiarity breeds attempt.
So did she have any problem with your age or anything, or she welcomed you with open arms?
Oh, we all had our doubts, but it all went well.
Hmm. Okay.
And then we worked like dogs for 20 years, and then we were able to afford to do things, and she had horses, and we traveled, and the travel just became bigger and bigger. And, you know, it's an itch. Once you learn how to do it, and you can get rid of a lot of the just pain in the neckness of it, just keep planning the next one. And got a lot of miles, a lot of adventures. And, of course, I guess I should ask you, which would you rather have, dreams or memories?
Well, I know there's an answer when I got to the end of the book. I don't want to give it away for people, but I was going to pick the wrong one. Because the way I interpreted that question was, well, you can just have, well, no, okay. I was going to say memories because that means you've actually done something and you didn't just dream. However, I don't want to give it away what you said, but I liked yours better. Once I read the end, you have to get to the end of the book to get to this, but where is it?
In the epilogue.
We'd rather look forward than back. We prefer tomorrow to yesterday, and our favorite trip has always been the next one. And why not? You can't look forward unless you have a forward to look forward to.
Hey, pile it high and deep. That's part of the deal.
Well, will we meet new friends along the way? We hope so. When we started traveling, we didn't have any, and look at us now. Yes. So this is the epilogue, folks. You got to read the rest of it to get to the epilogue, but I'm feeling compelled to read this. Yes, this book is all about memories, and we are pleased to share them. But don't you think we'd rather go back and make them all over again than just remember and share? And don't you think we know that someday, like everyone, all we will have is our memories until we don't even have them? Still, there is only one way in life forward. Memories can hold you back. Memories can hold you down. Dreams, they get you up in the morning. Books to read, maps to study, places to go, people to see.
You know, I love the way that you withheld the ending from everyone so that they would have to read the book in order to find out. I mean, just that people were on the edge of their seats.
I kept them in suspense for about 30 seconds. Well, anyway, that doesn't give it away.
Yep.
But so when you started traveling, were you already writing the book, or you already went to those places and then you put them in later?
When we started traveling, we didn't know what we were doing. Actually, there's an ad that the line of which is, want to get away? It's an escape. It's a great escape. You don't know how you're doing it. You're scared the first time and probably scared the second time. And, you know, we went on a couple of group tours. And the wonderful thing about a group tour, and frankly, we only did one of them. Well, no, a couple of them. Is you get two tours for the price of one. One, you get to see the country that you're visiting, And two, you get to be entertained by the psychodrama from all the other people in the group.
And is that good or bad?
It depends, you know.
So when you, because it seems like, so can I just tell them, each chapter is a whole nother adventure of a legend who did incredible things. But did you just, let's say you went to 10 of these or whatever, and then all of a sudden you decided to write a book. You had already gone to them. Were you already looking for legends, or did you start this?
What started out was we were escaping, and we went to places as far away and as far out of the way as we could get to. And what we kept finding in these various places were people, alive or dead. And, you know, some of our best friends are dead, and they're wonderful friends because they don't talk back.
They don't argue. Yeah,
exactly. So you take them as they are, and what we stumbled into was that we weren't looking for places anymore. We were looking for these kinds of people. And of course, it was great because it gave us an excuse to even go to more out of the way places. And not that these places are places where we ate bugs or, you know, worms in order to survive. We had a few locusts along the way, but these are pretty nice places, and we tried to do it in a pretty nice way.
What was your first trip? Or the first one in the book?
Right. That's a very good question.
I mean, if you weren't originally looking for legends, you were just traveling, and then all of a sudden you figured out, oh, there's some pretty cool stories. Is that how it worked?
Well, there was an intervening step. We sponsored women's professional squash exhibitions.
You did? I played squash at Penn. I was the captain of the team. Did I tell you that?
Oh, go, girl!
Go Quakers! Go Quakers! Anyway, yeah, I learned how to play.
The team are coached by a good friend of mine, and they won the national championship this year. So,
who's your friend?
Gilly Lane.
Yeah, and Coach Wetzel. Did you know she just passed away? I don't know if you know.
Yeah. Yep.
She was my coach.
Oh, wasn't that great? So.
Yeah, wow.
We had a great gimmick. And what had happened, we'd run a professional squash tournament in Philadelphia for about 10 years. And it, when the sport was changing from hardball to softball, which was the international game. And we brought in all these pros, and we did it for about 10 years. And, you know, we got a little tired of it, and people kind of just took it for granted. But the people who were really grateful were the women players. So we called up the head of the women's organization and said, you know, we're going to wind down this tournament. What else can we do that would be fun? Where I wouldn't have to do any work, and, you know, nobody would know where I was, and blah, 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 blah. And so we started these exhibition tours, and the gimmick was that the women would fly in to a young squash country and play the best men. You know, they weren't playing Bobby Riggs. They were playing some guy who was 20, 22 years old, was a local pro. In one case, we went to Kenya and they brought somebody up from Zimbabwe. And the part that was so great was the women cleaned their clocks.
Yay, women. Woohoo.
For example, in Kenya, girls had not been allowed to play squash on the grounds that it was too dangerous. We went in there, and Sarah Fitzgerald, the world number one from Australia, played the number one professional who flew up from Zimbabwe and crushed him. And the day after that match, they changed the rules to allow girls to play.
Wow.
That was very fulfilling. And we ended up sponsoring women's events for about 20 years all over the world, in some of these countries, but not in all of these countries. I won't say cowardly, I won't say fearless, I will say prudent. You know, we didn't have a lot of confidence in ourselves in the beginning, and safety was in numbers. But as we went along, as we got more confident, and as we started looking out and seeing more places that weren't going to be squash related, we started traveling ourselves. We kept the sponsorship up with the women because they were all great. And, you know, what's the old line? All my friends are women's world champions. And we were very lucky, and it was a great setup because we could get them to places that they couldn't get to. But once we were there, they could get us in places where we couldn't get in. So,
like where? Like what do you mean?
The Prince of Bahrain's private royal quarters, where we had a karaoke contest.
Oh, my God. Wait, so they could get you in because they were world champions.
Right. And, you know, we were just, you know, part of the backup in the band, which was fine with me. We were having fun. And, you know, it was one of those things where before we walked in to the room, I was the most important person on the tour because I had paid for us to get there. But after we walked in, I was the least important person. Who wanted to know me? They all wanted to know the girls. So it was good for my ego, and I had a wonderful time, and we went, you know, there was one night where they opened up, they held the first professional squash exhibition ever held in China. And they set up a portable court on the Bund in Shanghai. And at that time, China only had 3 television stations. And they were on every single one.
Wow.
And they were so excited and so pleased that, shall we say, they were overserved in the bars afterwards. And, of course, the next day, we were all flying to Lhasa in what some would say is Tibet and some would say is China. And at 12,000 feet, you should have seen these people all crapped out on the ground at the Lhasa airport. It was fantastic.
That they were hungover?
Yes, hungover and with altitude sickness.
Why was that great? I'm missing that.
Because the day before was so incredibly great.
Oh. And these were the squash champions.
Awful.
These were the squash champions.
World squash champions, yes.
Did you ever have Alicia McConnell during that time?
We did not have her with us, but I know her. She was great at Penn.
Yeah.
And an American.
She came in right when I was leaving.
Yeah.
But I met her later. Yeah.
That's right.
Small world, right?
Woo. Wasn't that great?
Ned Edwards. You know Ned Edwards?
Yes, I know Ned very well.
Of course. Yeah. He was a friend of mine at Penn.
Good guy. He's the head of the National Squash Center in Penn. There's a Spector Center named after Arlen Spector, and his son was very generous, and it's become America's spot for all the national tournaments. The U.S. Open is held there. It's
what used to be the Ringe Courts, right?
Is now what used to be the Ringe Courts. What used to be the Armory at Drexel.
Oh, so it's not the one that Penn just opened. It's a whole
other another one.
Oh, wow.
And I think there's probably more squash courts in between Penn, Drexel, and the U.S. Squash Center within a 3-block radius than any other place in the world.
Wow. See, I didn't even know they opened that. That's amazing. Wow. Cool. And how did you guys get involved with squash? Was Barbara also a squash coach?
No, she was a basketball coach. Remember, I was the assistant.
Yes, I remember. But sometimes they do more than one sport, you know.
I learned how to play squash when I was in law school. In fact, I went to University of Pennsylvania Law School. I got a joint law degree and an MBA, and I started to play squash there, and then I joined a club called the Racquet Club of Philadelphia and was on board there and very active as the sport was changing from hardball to softball, and, you know, one thing just led to another. And,
So that was before you reunited with Scott and right or no?
It all kind of came together beginning in the early 1980s. Okay. And then we got more active in the squash in the 1990s and just continued on up. And we just kept going around.
Can I go back a sec?
Absolutely.
So what does one do with a dual law and MBA degree? What did you do for work?
Well, I could say stealing, counting, and keeping.
Okay.
But
Or you could say what you really did.
Well, I started out with a Wall Street law firm for a couple of years, came down with an accounting firm in Philadelphia. I wanted to learn how to run my own affairs. I wanted to learn how to structure real estate transactions. Mm-hmm. And I did. I also have an expertise in partnership taxation, and I was very lucky. I had one client that had gone to Princeton. I met one gentleman who had been at Princeton, had been in the eating club that I was in, and he was the only person from Princeton that I ever did business with. But then I started thinking of all the others, but he was the biggest one. Mm. And he was older than I, and we hit it off. And now his son-in-law and I run the family office. And so that was one side. And then on the other side, I bought real estate, and I was good to it, and it's been good to me. and Barbara's been with me every single step of the way, and I'm very lucky and I'm very grateful.
So where was that? Did you go back? Did you stay in Philadelphia?
Yep. Right now I'm sitting in Chestnut Hill, which is in the northwest section. It's a nice area in town, and I bought up a lot of apartment buildings. Not that there are that many of them. And, you know, what's the old line? I've had the best education in the world. Princeton University, the University of Pennsylvania Law School and Business School. And the most important thing I do is to make sure your toilet works.
Oh, my toilet works.
What's amazing is that if the roof leaks, people are reasonable. If the heat goes off, people are reasonable. If the lights go off, people are reasonable. But if the toilet won't flush, people go crazy.
I bet you have some good plumbers in your little Rolodex, right? Or is it you?
It's not me, but we have a crew, and we have outside people depending upon what we need.
Wow. So how many places, I mean, am I allowed to ask? How many toilets is that?
Enough to keep us busy.
Wow. I didn't realize that. So if a toilet doesn't, so if they don't have heat, what about water? Water's important too.
Yeah, but if the water has stopped, okay, the people can leave their dishes in the kitchen sink. But if they can't go to the bathroom and get rid of it, that's...
Yeah, but they can't brush their teeth. They can't drink water. I would say that's pretty up there.
Patience.
And you can't flush.
Yeah, patience.
I mean, you can flush once.
All right.
You got to save it.
What is it? Is this what University of Pennsylvania humor is?
Oh, no, this is... Having kids, like, they potty mouth, yes. I don't think I ever grew out of it, but.
Well, I didn't grow out of it either. And that's another great thing about Barbara. Yep. She does appreciate my jokes.
Well, that's very important, right? That's very important. Yeah. So, okay. So, all right. So that was your career. And obviously you were blessed and you had a great partner and you did some amazing things, which allowed you to do all these other things, right?
Well, and you know, writing the book.
Oh, wait. So go back. So you're doing the squash.
Right.
So you did it at Penn for 10 years. So I'm trying to figure out how old you were. You graduated at 21. You didn't meet Barbara again for 13 years. You went somehow back, got your law and MBA. We're doing all these things, but it seems like you had 30 years of squash. So that would take you from 30 to 60 or from 25 to 55, or I'm just trying to see what ages were you actually traveling?
Oh,
you know,
traveled. We started in the mid-90s and okay. We kept going up until COVID, 2020.
Okay. So my math is right, you were in your 50s when you started.
Right.
Okay, so you were doing the squash. Oh, and you were traveling with the squash. Okay, so that's amazing, right? So when did it... So you got to go to all these places. You... Now, are any of those places in the book, or were all your book stories later when you branched out without squash?
I would say Bangkok, Kathmandu, but those are St. Petersburg. We were the first professional squash exhibition ever held in Russia, as well as China.
All right, we need to go to the commercial break, but let me just ask you, how did you arrange that? Was that your job or was that other people?
other people. Okay. A gentleman by the name of Andrew Shelley was the executive director of the Men's Professional Squash Association, then the Women's Professional Squash Association, then the World Squash Federation, and he got a QED or whatever it is from Britain as a, I think it's one step below a knighthood. The guy was unbelievable. He did, wow. He did all the organizing, and he was one of the best partners I've ever had. And you know, I have a joke that I make.
I'm already laughing. It's good.
In the real estate world, a typical financial model for an apartment building is that you would have a 5% vacancy. Now, we probably have historically a 2% vacancy. And one time, somebody who worked in our office came in and said, "Tom, I don't understand it. These people have all these unreasonable demands, and they want this, and they want that, and they want this, and they want that, and you always give it to them, and oh, maybe that's why we don't have any vacancies." So one of my jokes is that everybody screws me, but I make it up in volume. Well, so...
All right, we'll be right back. We need to take our commercial break, and then we're going to come back and hear more stories, all right?
Okay.
Be right back. Hold on to that thought.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
All right. Welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you'd like to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your schools, businesses, or teams, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a consultation. They will totally take care of you, and it'll be something you're very happy you did. And as always, if you aren't someone who speaks up, one of my books, is called Real Talk, and this one will get you going. It's full of great stories and will really inspire you. To book a consultation with me, you can send an email to Hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com. If you want, let's see, a great story, summer reading, the second piece of French toast. You're not allowed to judge me, but it's my memoir. And then if you find yourself on what you call the wrong side of life, read this one. Your bullshit is your blessing. It's techniques and tools for getting from what I call the left side of life, where everything looked kind of bad, back over to the right, where things are fun again. And now we have I have to say it correctly. The Tarantino part of Scott and Tarantino. Welcome back. Hello. All right. So your partner was Andrew Shelley, and I'm assuming he got you into all those amazing places. So,
well, what I was about to say is that
I'm glad you remembered. Yeah.
A good partner is a real blessing. And the essence of a good partner is that while you are looking out to protect their interest, they are looking out to protect yours. And so rather than holding your cards close to your vest, you can be totally open-handed, and the trust and the teamwork is fantastic. And he's one of the best partners I've ever had. And I still do have him. In fact, he is finishing up. We created together the World Squash Library, and he is finishing up a pictorial history of squash, which I guess this is a year for books, but okay, I think my book is better than his book. But
I hope he has Coach Wetzel in there.
His book is great. And so I can't say enough about the guy. And certainly I can't say enough about the person who's my partner in the family office we run, because he also looks out after my position. So I look out after his. I'm very, very lucky with people.
Wow. All right. So back to your travels. I'm trying to figure out how you, so each place there's pictures, they're like beautiful pictures. There's a story about a person from each place who was a legend, right? I mean, they're amazing. They're amazing stories. At first I was like, yeah, whatever. A lot of pictures. But then I got into it and I was like, oh my God. And look at what this one did. And look at what this one did. And it was like one after the other of courageous people. You know, I have some that are floating through my mind, but they were driven, like, right? They were driven to go beyond safety, beyond where people had been, right?
They took risks. They had ideas. Yeah. One of my favorite stories involves El Chaton, which is down at the bottom of Argentina in Patagonia. It's a place where there are two wonderful mountains, Cerro Torre and El Chaton. And the story involves two guys who fancied themselves as dirtbags, beach bums, and in 1968 got in a van and drove 16,000 miles from California down to the bottom of Patagonia, and then climbed this one mountain, Mount Fitzroy. And then on the way back, you can imagine them talking, and one guy says to the other, well, you know, I really like this mountain climbing stuff.
Is that them?
That's they, yes. And on the far left and second from the left, and the one guy goes, I really like this mountain climbing stuff. I like the outdoors. I'm going to create a clothing company, and I'm going to name it after where we just were, Patagonia. And I'm going to use the mountain that we just climbed, Mount Fitzroy, as the company's logo. And the other guy goes, well, you know, I've started a clothing company too, but I named it after the hardest side of the mountain to climb, North Face, which isn't the hardest mountain to climb in Patagonia. The West Face is, because it faces all the winds coming in over the Patagonia ice field. But you get the point. And
so did they just happen to build these billion-dollar companies? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, because went mountain climbing and now they're billionaires and they donate the money to the forest. But
yes,
they just happen to.
Yeah, pretty great, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, but things like that happened. There was a fellow in Bangkok who was with the OSS, the CIA originator, and he fell into Thai art sculpture, and he created a clothing company with silks, and he was fantastic as well. I won't tell you what happened to him. Yeah, I mean, I gotta not tell you something.
And yeah.
Everyone.
63. Okay, hold on. I'm finding him. Hold on. Was this him?
You got it. And then one of our last trips was, I don't know why, but one day I'm going through and I'm Googling Zorba the Greek dancing on the beach. And lo and behold, up popped Stavros Beach on the northern side of Crete, which is where they filmed the final dance, Anthony Quinn and Tony Bates.
There we go.
And we went there, and I got a picture of Barbara dancing on the beach. And that was the last trip we went on together because COVID came, and then, right, Nikos Kazantzakis, one of my heroes.
Was he the friend of Zorba, or was he Zorba?
No. Zorba was a real person. He was a friend of Zorba.
Okay.
And...
oh, here's Zorba.
They did, that's right. They did work lignite mine together, which failed.
Oh.
And he loved Zorba so much that after Zorba died, he sat down and wrote Zorba the Greek. Not so much to remember him, but to resurrect him. And, you know, great spot. I can remember as a kid going to Little Arts Movie Theater in New Haven, Connecticut, and seeing the movie. And so it's something that's lasted us all our years. And it was nice to know that there was a real place.
So you went. So you, wow. You went to some cool spots.
Well, it's all make-believe. I mean, that's the nice thing is you wonder what kind of life you're going to have. What are you going to do that's going to be you? And the thing about travel is that, well, at first... you think it's artificial because this is not something naturally happening. This is something that you make happen. And then you realize, stupid you. You make everything happen. You know, Your life, you just don't sit there and your life happens and, you know, you get hired for this or you, you know, get fired for that or, you know, somehow you go to this place or you go to that place. No, you decide that this is what you're going to do. And you do it, and that's your life.
Okay. So did you...
joke?
What?
Time for another joke?
Sure. Go ahead.
No, just changing it. Okay, I don't want to get too serious.
Oh, okay. No. I'm just saying, you know, like, you went to all these really cool places that if you weren't doing the research, well, I don't know if you were doing the research for the book or if the book came after you did all the traveling, but you did a lot of research, so you must have done the research before you went.
Partly,
so you had to know where to go.
Because right? here's another thing they don't tell you about traveling.
Yeah.
I don't care how great it is. It's the best place you've ever been to. You're only going to be there for 10 days, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But the research, the preparation, anticipation, 6 months, 8 months, you can enjoy the whole thing and you end up learning so much. And if there's anything, as well as being a book about travel, it's a book about books. Because I wouldn't know about these places unless I'd read about them. And there are people that I allude to in the book who, for example, went to climb in Patagonia because they read about climbing in Patagonia. And it's not that you're necessarily everything new under the sun, but everything's new for you. Everything's new for me. And, you know, you want to make a good faith effort to learn. And then all of a sudden, whoa, why didn't I know that before? I guess there are two chapters that were next to each other. One was Zermatt, about the first person to ever climb the Matterhorn, and his close friend who ended up being his competitor. And then how 15 years later, there they were together in Riobamba, Ecuador, climbing in the Avenue of the Volcanoes. And
is he the one whose brother died, who he took his brother?
No, that's Reinhold Messner.
Oh, okay.
He was the one in Vilnius, Sud-Tyrol, which is in northern Italy. And no, that one's the Matterhorn.
Yeah.
That one's
that's what you were just talking about. Okay. I know. Did you just happen to, I know you have your stories, but I want to know, did you find the people in the places that you wanted to go, or did you find the people and then go there?
Both. It was more, for example, at the beginning, we didn't know what we were doing. And we went to Luxor, and we had never heard of Jean-Francois Champollion, who was a Frenchman who translated hieroglyphs. And when we went into the Valley of the Kings, one of the burial spots of one of the kings was where he had spent 2 weeks living when he went to Luxor in the late 1820s. We didn't even know about it at the time. If we'd known about it, you know, we lucked into it. And I guess one phrase, I'm going to go look for it in the book because it's a great line, and it just kind of explains. It's in our chapter on Lhasa, where we're talking about Heinrich Herrer and the Dalai Lama. And Heinrich Herrer and the Dalai Lama remain lifelong friends. They shared the same birthday, the 6th of July. Once Herrer asked if this was fate, divine providence, luck, or coincidence. All of these, His Holiness replied with a smile. And for us, everything was luck, was a coincidence, was destiny. It just happened. And even, you like that one?
Jim Corbett, yeah. He was really cool.
He's the greatest killer of man-eaters in history. Yeah.
They're all interesting. I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm not going to be able to ask you questions in a few minutes, so I have to ask them now. Unbelievable. We have to wrap up already. We have to start our wrap up. What would you like to, I know you're in the middle of a story, but I interrupted you, but what would you like to, what's your most important message to leave people with? I know you've done a lot of traveling. You've learned about these legends. What would you say?
Just do it. You're going to stumble through. You're going to be in embarrassing situations. You're going to get food poisoning. Don't eat the salad dressing in India. But guess what? Fortune favors the brave. That's what I'll leave you with.
Wow. All right. Well, we still have a couple more minutes. So you can leave us with a little more.
Okay. So for an encore.
I started early to wrap up. So keep going, baby. Keep going.
For an encore, I would turn you to our epilogue. And as we were, before I go there quickly, at the end of the Luxor chapter, one of our lines was, Champollion was so all over Luxor that he not only impacted what we saw, he impacted what we didn't see. And what we didn't see was the obelisk on the right side as you enter Luxor Temple. And the reason it's not there is because Champollion advised the King of France that if France wanted to have an obelisk, this was the one it should have. So France got it. But then when the obelisk arrived, it had at its base 4 baboons standing on their feet with their hands up, facing the sun, full frontal exposure. And in Paris, they were just shocked. So they cut off the pedestal. And I never knew where it went, but I'm going to say 3 months ago, as I was going through the book for the 10 millionth time, looking for corrections or whatever, I said, why don't I go and Google missing base of the obelisk? And lo and behold, it turned up. And what happened was it had been stored in the basement of the Louvre for almost 200 years. And in 2012, the French took it to a regional museum they were creating in northern France. where it's on display today. Just little. Now, how would you ever find that out?
Right.
You know, is that coincidence? Is that destiny? Is that persistence?
I think it's curiosity.
Hey, hasn't killed me yet.
Right? If you weren't curious, you wouldn't have looked.
Well, I guess that applies to the book.
Right, exactly.
We wouldn't have looked.
That's right. You wouldn't have found any of it. All right, so here we go. Thank you so much. The Tarantino part of Scott and Tarantino. Thank you for writing this. If you love to travel and you love legends, please get the book. And it's fast. It's wonderful. You will enjoy reading it. So thank you so much. Anything in closing?
Thank you very much. It was lots of fun. And you look like a jock to me. I could just see you out there pounding the ball.
That's right.
All the best.
With little dead shots, right?
Thank you.
On the wall. Okay. Thank you so much. I love talking about squash with someone who knows way more than me. So thank you so much. Great to have you.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.